Welcome to the 11KBW podcast on an education law update by Tom Cross. This talk was given at the 11KBW Local Authority Conference on the 1st of October 2015. For more podcasts and information, please visit 11kbw.com.
This is an education case law update. Busy year, I think, for education cases. And when one searches it, as I have for this paper and does some research on it, greatest activity, I think, in the area of upper tribunal special educational needs cases. That's the highest proportion of where there's been litigation, and also some important judicial reviews on a number of topics. Here are the topics which, in the reasonably short time, I'm going to try and say something about this morning. Something on SEN, related disability discrimination, and a bit on transport admissions, the London Oratory case and the nursery education case in which both Nigel and James were involved. And to start with the area of the greatest activity, I want to highlight two important cases in the SEN field, really about substantive law. The first of them is the Sea and Oxfordshire case, which is a not uncommon example of a pretty paper-heavy case, principally about whether or not a child should have an educational boarding placement and also raising a transport point. And I can tell you, having acted for the authority in this case, that by the time the bundle started to exceed 1,500 pages, both parties started to feel there was just about enough evidence for the tribunal to make a decision. The waking day argument in that case, the residential argument, was a typical one. The child had significant behavioural difficulties. And the parents' main argument was, look, the child needs a waking day curriculum so as to ensure that there's a consistency of approach in the way that the adults deal with the children, both outside and inside the normal school day. And that aspect of the case was quite properly dealt with by the tribunal. So it's a good example of a proper application of the law on residential schooling. But what had happened in the case was that during the course of the tribunal proceedings, which had ended up lasting over a number of different days over time, the parties had agreed that the child should go to a particular school. The school had flexible provisions, so it could either offer a day placement or a boarding placement. And just before the final day of hearing, some 8 or so months after the tribunal proceedings had started, the child had in fact just started a couple of days before. And at that final day, it was argued by the parents that the length of the journey between home and school for the child, which they said was about 2 hours each way, was such that because of the state in which the child was arriving at school, the tribunal should actually order residential on that basis. Particularly because it was said, by analogy with other school transport cases, look, this is a child who's arriving at school in a state unfit to learn. Now, the tribunal disposed of that argument on the facts. It basically said, because this child has been there for such a short time, there simply isn't the material from which the tribunal here could properly have concluded that she'd be arriving in a state unfit to learn. But the judge did say, which is what I've put on the slide, the position might be different in other cases. He said, if a journey that a child would have to undertake to or from the nearest school that's capable of meeting his or her SEN is or has an effect on the child such that it's not reasonable to expect the child to undertake it, and if a residential placement is not otherwise required on social care grounds, it certainly seems to me to be clearly arguable that a residential is required on educational grounds. So getting residential on the basis of the effect of a long or difficult journey on the child when they travel to school. Now, what's said there is not yet at least established law. Strictly speaking, the Upper Tribunal didn't need to decide that. But I think it's expressed in terms that it's quite likely to be followed in future cases. And the lesson, I suppose, for authorities is just to be aware that particularly in cases whereas here, the authority agrees a placement, which is perhaps flexible as to the amount of time that the child is there. If there is a transport issue, are the parents going to seek residential with the additional cost to the public purse that that'll almost certainly involve on the basis of the nature of the journey? The second case, slightly different point, is the H&A case. This was a case in which Clive Sheldon was involved about what special educational provision, SEP, may be required for a child with harmful sexual behaviour, which may be learned harmful sexual behaviour. So that's what the child has here. The child has severe social communication difficulties, which much exacerbate harmful sexual behaviour, which he has learned essentially having it is recorded, spent a period of time at a primary school where he was exposed to pornography and possible sexual abuse. So the issue arose before the tribunal as to whether the therapy that the child needed to deal with this harmful sexual behaviour was special educational provision, which of course meant it had to go in part three of the statement, or was non-educational provision, so in a different part of the statement. And the tribunal had said it was non-educational because what it would be dealing with this therapy is responding to something that was, as it put it, learned behaviour. The child's difficulties in relation to sexual behaviour wasn't an inherent part of his learning difficulty. It was something that had been, his learning difficulty was exacerbated by the fact that he had been exposed to sexual behaviour that was difficult for him. And the tribunal said, look, that's irrelevant. Whether or not it's learned behaviour is irrelevant to whether or not SEP may be required. The judge said, I'm unable to see that whether it's required in response to behaviour that's learned is a legally correct test to apply in determining whether something constitutes special educational provision. The judge said, look, you can test the matter in this way. There are lots of different things in education that deal potentially with someone responding to learned behaviour or attitudes or views. Education isn't just a matter of learning French verbs or the principles of physics. It may also be, an example being religious education, sex education, or the increasing emphasis that's placed on learning British values in schools, something that's about challenging or in relation to pre-established views, learned views and attitudes that the child already has. So there's no reason why SEP can't be dealing with that sort of thing also. A couple of cases next on SEND procedure, both of which are, I think, proof positive of something some of us practising in this area have suspected for some time, which is that the judges in this jurisdiction can be crazy. The first is the Kensington and CD case. This case was about the approach that a tribunal should take to non-standard expert evidence. I'm not talking here about your standard OT, occupational therapy evidence, SALT evidence, educational psychology evidence. This was a case where the child was profoundly deaf. And there were issues in the case in relation to the size of environment he should be in connection with that, and also the overall acoustic quality and characteristics of the competing school's environments. And fairly unusually, because of the nature of that issue, each party wanted to instruct an acoustic engineer to go round to each school and to examine its characteristics in light of this child's particular difficulties. They do so, they produce each report, produces evidence which is relevant to those issues. But unfortunately, although the tribunal's got the written material, neither of these experts, these acousticians, actually are present in person at the hearing. It may be, I don't know, that one of the reasons why the parties in this case felt that they couldn't call the experts was because of the practice that has developed in this tribunal of the tribunal expecting only a certain limited number of witnesses to attend, normally three. It may be, it's not clear from the judgment whether or not that's the case. But if one finds oneself in this situation, this case is an example of where one might have to be quite robust as a party and push on the tribunal to make sure that you get the evidence you need. Anyway, in this case, the first tier tribunal had said, look, because these acousticians aren't present, A, and B, because they deal with stuff that's highly technical, we're simply not going to make any findings in relation to their evidence. And the upper tribunal didn't like that. So they said, no, this was, in a sense, an abnegation of your responsibility, of your function as a tribunal. You needed to make findings on these matters. And in doing that, and this is really the real significance of this case, the upper tribunal gave some pretty clear guidance about the procedure in these non-standard expert cases. I've set out the guidance in full in my paper, but just a couple of quick points. One, if you want expert evidence of this nature, tell the other side as soon as possible and try and get an agreement for a joint expert. That's something that's reflected also in the courts. The family courts, for example, deal with the desirability of getting single joint expert evidence on these issues. And secondly, make clear to the other side and the tribunal the particular issues on which you want these experts to give evidence. Thirdly, I suppose, hope for a good judge. Now, you may be in difficulty, I have to say, if you're allocated the judge the subject of the next case, the somewhat ironically, in this case, named Judge Brain. He was at the heart of the fairly extraordinary events in the LW and Norfolk case. That was a case all about the sometimes confusing procedure which applies when someone applies for permission to appeal the decision of the tribunal, of the first-tier tribunal. And the first-tier tribunal faced with that application has to decide whether or not to review, within the meaning of Rule 9 of the first-tier tribunal rules, the previous decision of the tribunal. That's a provision, that review provision, which also applies, as many of you all know, in other specialist tribunals as well. For example, there's a similar, though not identical, one in the information tribunal context. So the parents lose this case at tribunal. They apply to the first-tier tribunal, as one does, for permission to appeal. That application comes before Judge Brain, who hadn't been on the original tribunal, as is standard practice. Judge Brain, as required under the rules, considers whether or not to review the decision. He thinks that there's an error of law in it, which proves to be uncontroversial, and he decides to remit the case to the tribunal, but only to rehear the case in relation to the particular matter where he found they'd erred. But what he also did, Judge Brain, was he went off to speak to the original tribunal judge, a judge called Judge Vassy, in relation to other grounds of appeal. And he said in his decision, having consulted Judge Vassy, and in reliance on her record, her recollection and consultation with other panel members, he was satisfied, Judge Brain, that the tribunal had robust evidence for findings on particular aspects of the case, on which he then proceeded to give a commentary. And he said to the tribunal, when you rehear this, and when you re-give your reasons, which you need to do, because they were deficient in the first place, on these other issues, you shall do so in accordance with my own commentary as to the reasons for your decision in the first place. Now, all that should have been, of course, in accordance with Rule 9 of the Tribunal Procedure Rules, which is the relevant rule on how to conduct a review and one's powers as a judge when there is a review. Not surprisingly, the upper tribunals say, no, Judge Brain got this horribly wrong. And there are at least two significant procedural irregularities, as they describe them, which are those on the slide. First of all, the judge shouldn't have discussed matters with Judge Vassy in the way that he did. The upper tribunal said that, you know, such a discussion was unnecessary for the purposes of Judge Brain carrying out his function. Secondly, and this is a significant point even in cases without such extraordinary facts, the judge shouldn't have fettered the discretion, it is suggested, of the first-tier tribunal in the scope of what it reconsidered when the matter was remitted to it. There's also a third point in these cases, which is about the right to representation, to make representations when a judge is minded to set aside or to find an error of law in relation to the first-tier tribunal's decision. A third point is the judge in the upper tribunal is emphasising parties need to be given the chance to comment when the judge reviewing the original decision is thinking of setting it aside. So although the facts are a bit extreme, this ends up actually being quite an important case on the regularly occurring phenomenon of parties making applications for permission to appeal to the first-tier tribunal, which are then the subject of a review. Moving away slightly from Sen, I want to say something about the Exham Governors of School case. This was a disability discrimination case. Two significant things about this case. The first is that it seems now, I think, to have resolved a debate that had been lingering, mostly in exclusions cases, about whether children with difficulties which manifested in a tendency to physical abuse of others were disabled within the meaning of the Equality Act 2010. And on that issue, the upper tribunal essentially upheld an earlier decision of Mr. Justice Lloyd Jones, as he then was in another case called X. That is an issue which essentially arises because the Equality Act disability regulations provide, as had predecessor regulations, that for the purposes of working out whether or not someone's disabled under the Equality Act, a tendency to physical abuse of other persons is not to be treated as an impairment under the definition of disability. And the issue had been whether if a child that has a disability which is not a tendency to physical abuse per se, but which is an impairment which manifests in a tendency to physical abuse, is, as it were, disqualified or taken outside of the statutory definition in Section 6 of the Act. And in short, the upper tribunal said Mr. Justice Lloyd Jones was right, and what that means is this. If a child's impairment manifests in a tendency to physical abuse of others, which may, for example, commonly be the case in the case of a child with ADHD, for example, you've got manifestation of a tendency to physical abuse. If the child has such a tendency, in fact, and if the matter in relation to which it is said there's been discrimination, so the exclusion or a failure to make reasonable adjustments of some sort, if that is, in fact, something that is related to that tendency. They're excluded for exhibiting that tendency, or there's a reason, failure to make reasonable adjustments in relation to that tendency. The child then cannot claim disability discrimination in the first place because they're outside of the definition of disability. So that's the first point, upholding previous law on that. Second point about this case, guidance on meaning of what the expression tendency to physical abuse actually means. Three things perhaps just to draw from that. Firstly, the upper tribunal says this is ultimately an issue of fact, as they put it, eminently appropriate for consideration by a tribunal. Secondly, the upper tribunal makes the point that it's not necessary for a tendency to physical abuse to be manifested frequently or regularly. And although there has to be an element of violent conduct, that conduct doesn't have to be serious, they say. But at the same time, thirdly, in the absence of what it describes as some sort of misuse of power or coercion by the child in that conduct, a finding of physical abuse would be likely to require careful justification. So within the guidance given in this case, there are points pulling in both directions for and against whether or not a child is going to have that tendency on the facts. And further questions on that one, I think, to James Cornwell and Clive Sheldon, who acted. I should just also briefly mention that this case, the Exon Governors of a School case, has already been applied by the upper tribunal in a case I did called C versus I School, which isn't yet reported, but which is an instance of an application on the facts to the guidance given on the meaning of tendency to physical abuse. School transport, next on this whistle-stop tour, and I think quite a useful decision for authorities, thanks to Paul Greatorex, who was for East Sussex in the P and East Sussex case, which was principally about the proper construction of Section 508B of the Education Act 1996, which is part of the Act dealing with the obligations in relation to transport arrangements, and which requires authorities to make, in the case of eligible children, such travel arrangements as they consider necessary in order to secure suitable home-to-school travel arrangements for the purpose of facilitating the child's attendance at the relevant educational establishment, and you have to make those for free. So the eligible child in this case lives quite a long way away from home, nearly 30 miles, but she has regular medical appointments during the school day. And previously, that situation had been accommodated because the authority provided transport to her in the form of an individual taxi. She was on her own in the taxi. The authority, after time, changed the position so that she would be provided with transport, but in a shared taxi with others, which naturally reduced the amount of flexibility that there was for the journey to accommodate her going to the medical appointments. And under the new arrangement, it was quite difficult for her, therefore, if she had to go to a medical appointment, to get back to school afterwards or to attend after school clubs after she'd been to the doctor. So the main ground of challenge in this case is, look, those arrangements are in breach of Section 508B of the Act. And the court said, no, that's wrong. And in doing that, it stressed the purpose of the provision, which is the key point from this case. The purpose of this is about facilitating the child's attendance at school. The purpose was not, said the court, to facilitate attendance at the child's medical appointments, however desirable a purpose that might be. So this is a duty about transport to and from school. It's not a duty about, as it were, transport to suit within a school day. There were also equalities points in the cases which were rejected on the facts. I'm going to move on in light of the time to say something about the London Oratory school case. Lots of members in chambers involved in this, Messrs. Gowdy, Milford and Moffat amongst them. This was a paper-heavy judicial review challenge to the decision of the school's adjudicator all about the faith-based oversubscription criteria of the London Oratory School, which is a Roman Catholic academy. So it's not a local authority maintained school, obviously, because it's an academy, and it's not a school for which the local authority is the admissions authority under the School Standards and Framework Act. May still be very relevant, though, to local authorities this case, because, for example, it is possible for authorities to be the admissions authorities in the case of voluntary controlled schools, which are of a religious character, and therefore the admissions code, in accordance or under which the admissions authority is obliged to act, may yet apply. Just a few points to draw from this. Firstly, what the court said about a particular paragraph in the admissions code. Paragraph 1.38 of the code had said that when you are constructing your faith-based oversubscription criteria, admissions authorities for religious schools have to have regard, those are the words, have regard to any guidance from the body or person representing the religion, which in this case was the Archdiocese of Westminster. What had happened in this case is that over the years the school had had a number of disagreements which sought to take positions on their admissions criteria which differed from the Archdiocese's guidance. So the court looked in considerable detail about what the expression have regard meant to in the guidance, and one has quite a detailed judgment on that from Mrs. Justice Cobb. Mr. Justice Cobb, I'm sorry. Possibly inaccurately recorded in the transcript, I think, which is the reason for that. Reason for that mistake, but ends up concluding that admissions authority, what does this mean have regard to? They've got to take the guidance into account, and if they decide to depart from it, they must have clear reasons for doing so. Reasonably orthodox approach, but a very detailed discussion on that. The court also said that the adjudicator had made certain flawed findings in other events. For example, the adjudicator had found that particular criterion of the school had a tendency to disadvantage well-off, the less well-off families who would be wishing to go to the school. Having reached that reaching that conclusion, having gone off and found a load of statistics about the socioeconomic characteristics of people going to the school in the area, and the school said, and the court said, look, that's not a good enough analysis. You need to decide whether or not the particular criteria cause the disadvantage in question, that they are the cause of it. Not all of the challenge succeeded, I have to say, and to James's great credit, no doubt, the court, for example, upheld the adjudicator's conclusion that the school's Catholic service criterion was unlawful. That was one which gave priority to people who could demonstrate practice in the Catholic faith in a way that the school's advisory body had said was not permissible. I'm only going to show you the slide of Morris, which is a case that Andrew Sharland talked about this morning in the context of consultation, in which you've seen already, and is also an education case. Plenty then to have been getting on with for the education lawyers, and a bit of a bumper edition, but I hope at least some of you will have heard something of at least some interest. Thank you very much.